enabling legislation that created our court that encourages us to sit in other parts of our circuit from time to time. Circuit court is a country. We've been in this area, I think, about 12 years ago, was our last visit. And we're very appreciative of the cordial reception that Dean Kramer, the faculty and the students here at Stanford have extended to us. And happy to be here. Our first case this morning is, or this afternoon, is 087013, Homer, the Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Wright.
Thank you very much. Edward Rindis on behalf of Leroy Comer. The appeal here is from a refusal of the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims to exercise any jurisdiction at all over Mr. Comer's claim for total disability based on unemployability for the time period February 1999 to May of 2004. And this court has jurisdiction under Section 7292A because this case turns on the application of Roberson, one of the Federal Circuit's landmark precedents in the area of veterans, to the record in this case. And although this court has to be comfortable with jurisdiction, it's notable that the government isn't challenging jurisdiction in any way. The allegation below was that there was no jurisdiction because Mr. Comer had not pursued TDIU, and he did not perfect his appeal to the board. That's the allegation.
Mr. Ryan, if in fact the government does not challenge jurisdiction, we still have jurisdiction? There was no challenge of the jurisdiction?
Right, no, the court has to be comfortable for itself that it has appellate jurisdiction, so that's for the court to conclude. And I think on the facts here, where we have the issue of whether Roberson applies as being the hinge issue, that's clearly within the scope under 7292 for this court, for this panel. So I don't think there's a jurisdictional problem, but you're right that the court and this panel has to decide for itself and be comfortable itself that it has jurisdiction.
The government cannot admit jurisdiction no matter what.
That's correct. So the issue, as framed by the government in its brief, is whether Roberson's applicable at all. Of course, Roberson held that the duty of the Veterans Administration to optimally develop the claim of the veteran requires an acknowledgement that the veteran is seeking total disability based on unemployability when there's a record of unemployability and when there's a request for as high a claim for disability as can be accomplished.
And Roberson, wasn't there an indication that the veteran wanted as much disability benefit as he could get? And is that not the case here?
There's no distinction that's been argued by the government or that's apparent in the record that we've been able to spy on that point. So I think in both cases, the veteran said, I want high rating as I can accomplish. And I think even under the practices in the Veterans Court, that's the way it's construed. These are constant requests.
Is this the maximum indication of a rating that he's asked for 80% in the May 03 NOD? Where is there an indication that he wants TDIU?
Well, the indication for TDIU is implicit in the request for the higher disability, which he's clearly asked for. In fact, in the board decision itself, that acknowledges that he's seeking in excess of 50%. And for 100% schedule of disability evaluation. So the board itself acknowledged that on page 27 of the appendix. There's been no argument made, and I don't think there's a real debate that this veteran was seeking the maximum amount of disability. He had a 21 GAF rating. There's some people that have worked in this field for many years who have never seen someone that at one point was given a 21 GAF rating. That's basically completely non-functional as a human being. So I think the issue here is whether the Roberson rule of sympathy applies here. In other words, in optimizing what Mr. Comer was seeking here, was there an obligation to at least look whether there's TDIU and then to review within the scope of the jurisdiction whether there's TDIU?
Speaking of rule of sympathy, he did have representation though, didn't he?
Well, and he didn't have representation in the sense of counsel. So the first exception from Roberson.
Didn't he have organizational support?
He had organizational aid, that's correct, Your Honor. The first exception from rule of Roberson by the government raised is exactly the point Your Honor raises, which is the concept of an organizational aid exception. And that argument just cannot fly. That would take the entire veteran system, which is premised upon this rule of sympathy for veterans, that we're not going to treat them adversely, and to stand on its head. And this is really, I think, very simply dispatched with this entire argument. In Hodge v. West, this court found the rule of sympathy, that's sort of one of the root seminal cases on that point. And what the court did when it went through, this was Chief Judge Michel's opinion, went through the Veterans Judicial Review Act and those items, it said, okay, it's uniquely proclaiming and strongly proclaiming, and it stated in reviewing the legislative history that the Congress acknowledged that the way the system is at the point of that legislation, veterans routinely given organizational aids. And it said, and we're not changing that. By allowing judicial review, we are not changing that. Even though they have organizational aids, the rule of sympathy will still apply. It's right in the legislative history. So given that Congress, when it passed the duty to assist, that's 5107A, at the time acknowledged and said, we know that they're getting these organizational aids. And these people are not lawyers. They're helping hundreds of thousands of people every day around the country.
Sometimes organizational aides know more than some lawyers, not anyone present, of course.
No, I mean, there's no doubt that there's quality assistance that's given around the country, and that. But what we can't make is those people pariahs. We can't have veterans who maybe have 10% brain function, fearful of getting aid from someone at a local agency who's willing to spend time with them to make sure they can complete the paperwork, and say, well, now you're infected and you're being treated adversely by the entire system when it's all built on a foundation of duty of sympathy towards veterans. So the organizational...
Those are the steps that he went through here. He did it himself, didn't he?
Virtually everything except one step. I mean, the dogged persistence by Mr. Comer, given the psychiatric problems he had that are service-connected from his Vietnam service, are inordinate. So there's two exceptions that's argued for why Roberson's rule does not apply. That's it. One is this organizational aid exception. I think Hodge just eliminates that. That the legislation that created the rule of sympathy acknowledged that those aids were going to be given and that wouldn't change the sympathy. The second argument, reading the government's brief, is an appeal plea. Basically, the government argues, well, maybe when you read a claim, you read rule of sympathy and you imply TDIU in when you're seeking unemployability, when you're demonstrating unemployability and seeking a higher rating. But not in an appeal context. An appeal context is a procedurally different context, and we need to be stingier there. And that is squarely inconsistent with federal circuit law, the practice of the board, the practice of the appeals, Veterans Appeals Court. Let me start with just this year in the McGee case, which was Judge Gaiaris' opinion, the issue was squarely presented.
Ryan, it's not my opinion, it's the court's opinion. You mentioned before it was Chief Judge Michel. It's not his opinion, it's the court's opinion. And I think we should make sure that that's the case.
I will embrace that, and I appreciate that. And the court's opinion was that Roberson requires the RO and the board to fully and sympathetically develop a veteran's claim. So the argument distinguishing between the board and the RO, the regional office, just flies in the face of McGee from this year, and also the practice of the Court of Veterans Appeals itself in Eisenbart. The exact issue is presented, which is, is TDIU implied from the predicates that are shown in Roberson? And the Veterans Appeals Court said itself it was. So that's the way, is this in federal circuit law? That's the law that the Veterans Appeals Court applies itself. There's no magic words. And importantly, the rules in the F case covers this, and this is in our reply brief in 7 and 8, states that in looking at the appeal, you don't just look at one notice of appeal the way you would for a represented party in a high-stakes patent litigation or government contracts case. You look at the entire record, oral testimony, everything. And on this record, there's simply no way to conclude that he was not seeking TDIU for the period prior to 2004.
But isn't the government really saying that Roberson was not applied because Roberson was very restricted to TDIU initially and not subsequently? Is that the essence of their argument?
I think the Veterans Court stated that the initial claim was significant, this distinction between initial claim and not initial claim, and it was relying on Norris. And Norris was in addressed in the original Roberson case. In the original Roberson decision, they said, Norris is different. And they said Norris is different because there was no debate about the initial claim in that case. Norris was about a supplemental claim that had never been dispatched with. And so the distinction between Norris and Roberson was that in Norris, there was no issue about the initial claim. There was no argument TDIU had come out of the initial claim. The argument was that supplemental claims had these predicates for TDIU in them. And the decision was straightforward from the Veterans Claims Court, which said those are still pending. Those are still pending until those are adjudicated. So you have TDIU claims that are live. And that set of circumstances has nothing to do with this case. We are talking about whether on appeal TDIU is present, and the board addressed all the predicates of TDIU on page 27 of the appendix.
You're in your rebuttal time, you don't say it.
Let me preserve the rebuttal time, but I would say that neither exception applies. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Actually, Roberson was applied in this case by the regional office. I think as was mentioned earlier, there was never a specific claim for TDIU made by Mr. Comer. However, reviewing the case, the regional office applied Roberson and its other regulations and awarded the TDIU claim effective in May 2004 upon the regional office's finding that the scheduler rating that Mr. Comer was seeking, he was seeking an increase from 50% to 70%. They granted a 70% increase as of the examination that supports that in the May 2004 time period. And so went ahead and granted TDIU. So that's a perfect example of.
So the question isn't whether or not TDIU or when.
Exactly. It's really an effective date argument. And our position is that Roberson, there's already a requirement in the regulation under 20.202. For the board to liberally construe claim documents, the substantive appeal documents.
Is the question of when within our jurisdiction?
Not precisely the question of when, Your Honor. I will answer the jurisdictional point that was raised earlier. To the extent the issue is framed as whether or not Roberson applies to these facts, we think that would be outside the court's jurisdiction. We don't understand that to be the case. We understand, in our briefs, we understood the position being argued by Mr. Comer would be simply does Roberson apply to substantive appeal and notice of disagreement type documents, not necessarily with respect to this case. This court doesn't have jurisdiction to find the application of Roberson in this case. It would appear to have a jurisdiction to determine the limits or extension of Roberson in general. And our position.
What would be the difference in this case?
Well, in this case, frankly, in this case, there are already factual findings of record that preclude any award of a TDIU effective date prior to the one that's already been awarded. And that's simply based upon the fact that TDIU, which was Roberson-inspired in this case, was premised upon the fact that the medical evidence showed the scheduler rating was greater than 50, was 70% as of May 2004. And as the court is aware, the TDIU regulation at 38 CFR 4.16 requires that in order for a claimant to be entitled to a TDIU award, he needs to have a scheduler rating greater than 60% for a single disability, or 70% in the case of multiple disabilities.
Well, it's clear that we couldn't get into that, but there's no reason why we can't get into the question whether Roberson applies beyond the regional office.
In a sense, it's true. That's true, Your Honor. But what I'm pointing out to you is that on remand, Mr. Comer is not going to get an earlier effective date for TDIU. This is not going to happen. So in a sense, any opinion this court issues with respect to the extension of Roberson is advisory because of the 4.16 prohibition in this particular case. There's already been factual findings. In fact, the only other way that a TDIU award could even be considered in this case would be under 4.16b, And it's not even an award, it's simply at that point a referral to a committee. But there's also a finding by the board in this case at Joint Appendix 27, discounting another extra scheduler rating under a different regulation, which would preclude award under 4.16b. So in the sense that...
That sort of begs the point a little bit, because he didn't have the representation he claims that he should have.
Well, I mean,
the complaint was not developed by the VA as it should have been, so we can't necessarily presume it would be different from going back.
We think the claim was developed. As I mentioned, he didn't seek TDIU. He was awarded TDIU by the Veterans Department. Yeah. They're the ones that granted the TDIU. So they did develop the claim, and they found a basis for awarding TDIU. The question now is he entitled to a TDIU award prior to the May 2004 date of the medical examination, which determines the basis for making that award? So that, you know, we think that the record has already, the factual findings of the board at Joint Appendix 27 already preclude any type of granting of TDIU prior to medical examination upon which the decision has already been based.
But Mr. Comer, couldn't he file a new claim at any time?
Yes.
Trying to bring it back in 1999? Because if he could establish his Q claim at that point, he could relate all the way back in 1999.
Yeah, technically, if he were to bring a Q claim, not even technically, Your Honor, yes. A Q claim is one of the two methods available. We're going to get into it a little bit later on this afternoon with respect to the two methods. But yes, Q is one of the methods by which a person could bring a claim and obtain an effective date back to the date of the original claim.
So they could advise.
Well, see, now that, again, that's getting to we'll address it, though. There's no requirement to advise on whether you have a Q claim. You can always bring a Q claim. See, that's the sense of, you know, since you can always bring a Q claim, there can never be any sort of prejudice resulting from somebody who, you know, wasn't awarded, you know, or informed. But to directly...
He has to go back and start all over again.
Pardon me?
And they didn't advise him of it. All this time has gone by. So the question is, why shouldn't...
I wouldn't request. I wouldn't say that there's any waiver with respect to the advising whether there's a potential Q claim. I also don't think on this record that there's any suggestion that there was a failure to advise somebody on the Q. That is the case in Malone later, but on this record, I don't see there being any question with respect to Q being even at issue. But
isn't Mr. Comer saying that you did not advise him that he didn't have a Q claim and he could bring it late back?
That Mr. Malone says that in the other case.
No, this was in the same. Mr. Comer said the same.
They're thing. Very similar, but the argument here is simply that that when they raised this earlier effectiveness date TDIU claim before the Veterans Court noted that it hadn't been raised before the board, so they didn't have jurisdiction to consider that. And so the argument here today is that the board and Veterans Court erred by not extending Roberson to the substantive appeal and notice of disagreement documents so that the board would have taken a look at that. And our position...
In relating it back to the 1999 at that point. The whole argument is a five-year time period.
Right, it is. The other case, but
forget about the other.
Yeah, I know. The 1999 date, but the response to that is, you know, as a matter of regulation, the board already is required to liberally construe these documents, these substantive appeal documents. And so any further challenge to that would simply be an application of law in effect. And so that's one. And two, as we indicated earlier, the substantive appeal requirements, as we point out in our briefs, specifically require specificity. And that's different than what happens at the pre-adjudication stage, which is what Roberson was concerned with. Roberson, the language from Hodge, which is drawn from the Veterans Judicial Review Act about sympathetically developing a claim to its optimum, refers to that point in time, subsequently addressed by the Congress with the Veterans Claims Assistance Act and the various 5103 notice and assistance requirements that involve the development of the claim itself, development of the record, going and getting evidence, and fully developing that record and identifying all potential claims and prior to making a decision.
But you're saying there's no obligation to tell the veteran that he could file a Q claim?
Not in this case. There's no obligation to tell the veteran that.
But that's argued here.
I don't see any obligation. Oh. It's in both cases.
Right? Both cases.
There's no obligation. And there's no error. There's no harm because he could bring.
The harm is he's going to have to go back to maybe 20 years later.
Well, he could have.
But if he's been told it still goes to 20 years.
Whenever he brings the Q claim, it always goes back to that original decision. So if he's trying to challenge the original decision, I mean, it's always been however much time elapses, it's always been involved. But there's no requirement in this case. Certainly in 1999, the VCA didn't even require the notice requirements that it does today. But subsequent to the VCAA, there was no requirement to issue that type of a VCA notice regarding Q. I mean, the VCA notice is about a claim on appeal, not an argument that could be made upon an otherwise final decision that either is challenged or it's not challenged.
But isn't the VA's burden to show or demonstrate that the VCAC notice was not prejudiced, Mr. Cohen?
Well,
their burden to show that?
If the issue is properly raised in the sense that there's an error, a question of the VCA notice error, at this point in time, yes, Your Honor, this court has held that to the extent the court below finds, the Veterans Court finds error, or the board finds error, that the Veterans Court cannot or must impose a burden on the Secretary to establish a lack of prejudice.
But you're saying there's no error.
But yes, that's the predicate before you get to the question of who bears the burden. There has to be an error, and there's no error here.
There's no obligation.
Exactly. In the VCAA.
And that's your argument. That isn't necessarily the case.
Right. But in the VCAA, you have requirements about, informing the claimant of what he must do to what kind of evidence. I mean, one of the ways to look at this is the VCA is all about, and before that, internal VA guidance was all about developing records. Mm-hmm. A Q claim doesn't involve a record. A Q claim is attacked upon an otherwise final decision. There is no evidence that's gathered with respect to a Q claim. That's based upon the decision that was made at the time, the law that existed at the time, and the record that existed at the time. And so there is no development as there would be in a regular claim situation with respect to a Q claim. And there's no notice requirement that we're aware of that imposes upon the VA a requirement upon receipt of a claim to say you might want to consider submitting a Q claim about that final decision you had 20 years earlier.
That would have been saying, look this over, and if you see any plain error which would result in reversing the decision, then you file a Q claim.
Well, I mean, and statute and regulations are a matter of public record as providing the right of a claimant to seek relief through the Q mechanism. But there's no requirement that we're aware of anywhere, including the VCAA, that VA is on has a duty upon receipt of a new claim. Because remember, what's coming in is a new claim. It's not a Q claim that's being submitted. It's a new claim. And that's when the VCAA kicks in. And that's when the development of the record has to take place. And so that's the focus of the VCAA notice. And the VA errs when they don't provide notice to the veteran as to the type of evidence that they're going to provide or the type of evidence that the veteran needs to give to the VA so that they can make a decision. All of that is irrelevant to a Q situation in which the record's been formed, it's been part of that final decision, the law exists, and as this court stated, it's very specific as to how you form a Q claim. In Andre, this court said, you need to have a specific allegation of Q in order to even state a claim for Q.
Yes, so, the only issue here is when he asked for TDIU.
When did he ask for TDIU? The answer to that question is he never did. The answer to that question is that, consistent with Roberson, the regional office in July of 2004 awarded him TDIU effective May 2004 based upon the medical examination that established that his scheduler rating exceeded the 60% minimum threshold under 4.16A. Once that happened, then he was potentially entitled to TDIU to the extent the record had evidence of unemployability, which this record did as of May 2004. That's a finding of fact by the board below. It can't be disturbed. And that's what our point about earlier effectiveness date. If you, setting aside the question of was this individual adequately represented by the Disabled American Veterans? And we think it was. And we think that a thorough and careful review of the Veterans Judicial Review Act legislative history points out very clearly what Congress thought of service organizations. They allowed service organizations to represent claimants before the adversarial court of Veterans Appeals.
What about the sympathetic reading?
Sympathetic reading has to do with a development stage. As I indicated earlier, sympathetic reading is very consistent, as it wasn't Hodge and Roberson, with the development of the record. But it's not, doesn't have a place or a role in the post-initial adjudication situation that we find ourselves in this case.
Sympathetic reading also has to do with sympathetically reading the regulations and statutes in favor of the benefit, if there's any doubt.
Right, and there's all 20.202 already provides that the board's going to liberally construe these types of substantive appeal and NOD documents.
And we often are asked to see whether they did. It's one thing to have a regulation that says it's a statute. And from the Supreme Court saying it, and looking to see whether the board and the...
Let me respond to that from a jurisdictional angle. I don't believe this court has jurisdiction to actually determine whether the particular, how it was applied in the particular case. I mean, at a minimum, this court might seek clarification about what the Veterans Court decision said, but this court doesn't have jurisdiction to determine, you know, whether or not the board properly applied 20.202 or some other regulation. That's for the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. And in this case, I would just finally note.
Mr. Hockey, before you finish, would it be correct to say that if we found that the Veterans Court did not properly interpret Roberson, that we can review that issue and give our interpretation of what Roberson said?
For the reasons I suggested earlier with respect to the factual findings by the board with respect to the TDIU, I think that it would be an advisory appeal in this particular case.
Not even the correct reading of Roberson by...
I think that the court should... I would recommend that the court wait for an appropriate vehicle to make that type of determination.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the parties agree that the issue on this appeal is whether appeal pleadings are read with rule of sympathy. You don't need to request TDIU. The point of Roberson is if there's unemployability shown in the record and you're asking for 70% or greater.
But Mr. Hockey said he never did ask for TDIU.
But he did ask for TDIU implicitly under Roberson. Roberson says the system is required to treat the statement that I want more than 70% disability and I'm unemployable.
Where is that statement?
TDIU. There's 29 references in the record that we have collected that are identified in our 29 places where they talk about unemployability. But let me address the appeal. So really, the rest of it's smoke. The issue is whether on appeal pleadings, the Roberson rule of implicitly reading a claim for TDIU applies or not. That's all it is. The McGee case from this year says this statutory system imposed on the board an obligation to fully and sympathetically develop the veteran's claim to its optimum. That's at the board level. In Eisenbart, the Veterans Claim Court itself said nods are read liberally. Our briefs have the Lewis case, the Cervello case. Everything says appeal pleadings are read with the same rule of sympathy that applies at the RO level. So the only argument being made is wrong. And then the only thing that leaves is two things. One is the idea that you have a DAV aid and therefore you forfeited the rule of sympathy. Hodge ends that. I don't have the time to go back through, but if you read Hodge, you'll see there's no way the entire system flips to adversarial because people use the aids that are helping 500,000 applicants a year and the whole system's now adverse.
Hodge says there's no way you can get a different result.
And I appreciate that. You're right. That's exactly what remains. Not in their briefs, because it's too facty to be in the briefs. The statement is, the result below, if you say Roberson applies to the appeal pleadings, and you say that yes, he did appeal it, and there should at least be a hearing by the Veterans Claim for Appeals, it's all moot because it's futile. He's gonna lose, he's a loser. That's speculation, it's inappropriate fact for this court. That's what the Court of Veterans Appeals is supposed to do. They refuse to even look at whether the board had evaluated correctly. He's pointing to the board. He's saying, the board decided these things, it's done, look for a better case, this isn't your case. You should send it back to the Court of Veterans' Appeals to look and say, did the board do the job or not? We're not asking you to do that. I think he's dead wrong. I think Mr. Comer is going to receive it when the facts are correctly construed and the law is correctly construed. But the point is, should he be deprived of any review at the Court of Veterans' Appeals on the ground that there's no jurisdiction because of their argument that Roberson doesn't apply to appeal pleadings, when McGee and all these other cases say it absolutely is? It's that simple. Now, there's a separate thing which got a little mixed up there, which is our request for a lack of notice. There was a lack of notice. That doesn't have anything to do with TDIU. There was confusion about that.
A lack of notice as to something that requires notice?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the debate, and our position is, which we laid out, is that Mr. Roberson, one of the many things he wrote from prison and mental hospitals and everywhere else is, you've acknowledged that you were wrong when you said my illness wasn't service-connected back in 1991 and 1988. You've now acknowledged that the government was wrong. I've been deprived for 15 years of benefits to which I was entitled, and you let me bang my head against the wall when I had no chance of that on my original claim, when all I needed to do was file a Q motion. And you knew that it was an unmistakable error to deny me of something that you now concede I was entitled to. And the question is, under the Act, is the government required to say, go file a Q motion, there's unmistakable error? What you're saying is there's unmistakable error, a Q motion. And I think it makes sense to do that, and here's why. The cost to the government of saying, go file a Q motion, these are circumstances that are tailor-made for that, is very, very low, as compared to other work that the government has to do in saying, you need to fill this element, that element, the other element. The cost is so low, and for someone like Mr. Comer, it's so beneficial to be told, you're in the wrong bucket. You need to be in the Q bucket if you want to get back to 1991. And I very much appreciate your consideration of this matter.
All right, thank you very much. The case is submitted.